Welcome to UCCF's Christian Persuaders podcast, a series of interviews with people from around the world gifted and passionate about communicating and defending the Christian gospel. For more information about UCCF, Christian Persuaders, and more episodes from this podcast, do go to uccf.org.uk/Christian-Persuaders. Well, today we're in dialogue with Peter May, who's going to try and persuade me of the importance of dialogue, and I anticipate we'll be considering Muriel Crouch and her pelvic floor and the fanatic in the attic. But first, Peter, I mean, what do you mean by dialogue? What is dialogue and what's that all about?
Well, dialogue clearly isn't monologue. And the church has survived on monologue for a great period of time, and that monologue is usually given 6 foot above contradiction.
Okay.
And where does a preacher ever invite people to give questions afterwards?
Mm.
It's very interesting that Tim Keller, for many years, did regular dialogue after his sermons
right. In
New York.
Uh-huh.
And his ministry has grown and flourished because he's then able to address the issues that people are actually thinking,
right,
rather than the preacher just guessing what people are thinking about.
Okay. But aren't you just becoming a slave to relevance then? Isn't that the driving force?
Well, no. I mean, dialogue is deeply rooted in the New Testament. And if you just follow through what Paul was doing at Thessalonica, at Athens, in Corinth, in Ephesus, there is reference the whole time to him reasoning with people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sounds to us a particularly sort of intellectual and rational engagement.
Mm.
But the underlying Greek word that is translated into English as reason is dialegomai. It involves a two-way flow. He was speaking, they were listening, they spoke, he listened.
Mm.
One of the things we read at the beginning of Acts 17 at Thessalonica is that he explained the gospel to people. Well, you cannot explain things unless there's an opportunity for dialogue. That's what exams are about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you understood what we've been lecturing about for the last 3 years? So it's only when people play it back to you, you realise they haven't a clue, they haven't got hold of this at all.
Okay.
Now, in terms of the gospel, we've got a lot of concepts and ideas we're trying to get across. And you do it in a dialogue situation, and the Apostle Paul did it in a dialogue situation. And as he explained, people would ask questions, and so he would be driven back to clarify and to produce evidences. And we read that he not only was explaining the gospel, but he was trying to convince them.
Mm.
And the end result is that people were persuaded. There's a whole sequence here. Now, the church, I think, has functioned far too long on thinking that evangelism is just about explaining the gospel. It isn't. It's about persuading people that it's true.
Mm. Okay, well, can you give us some examples of how you've seen this in your life?
Well, my own story of becoming a Christian, I had no one really to engage in with dialogue at all. It was a personal dialogue. I dialogued with books. I dialogued in my own head. Occasionally, I'd find people that I could raise particular issues with, but largely that was very unproductive. But in reading the New Testament, and I read it carefully, slowly, I used to... For three times, I read it through one chapter every night over a 2 or 3 year period. And there I would ask my questions of the New Testament. And so there was that dialogue going on. But it was an entirely personal thing. But what I saw going on was Paul in the marketplace engaging with whoever was there.
Mm.
Paul at the school of Tyrannus. Paul again and again in the synagogue, and we're told at Thessalonica, as his custom was, this is what he did. He explained, he convinced, he persuaded, he reasoned with them.
So there's Paul in the synagogue and Peter in the medical college.
Yes, and at that stage, the background thinking was this sort of, the gospel communicated by monologue, and Billy Graham, bless him, he made a fantastic impact in this country, but it was all by monologue. And that I didn't find in the New Testament in this way at all. And when I found myself at medical school, there was one wonderful occasion where we'd had a very powerful talk from Miss Muriel Crouch, who was a much-loved surgeon and anatomy teacher at the medical school. And she had given a very helpful talk that many students had come to. After that, a student asked me a fundamental question about the gospel, and I started to explain, and as I did so, various other people gathered round, and first two or three, four, and they were chipping in.
What was the original question that the girl asked?
The question she asked was, it was quite funny, really. She said that she'd been brought up, her parents were Presbyterians. She had been brought up as an Anglican, but she went to a Catholic school, and she had never heard of the idea that we must be born again.
Okay.
So what on earth did that mean?
Mm.
And so I set out to try and explain. And all these questions kept chipping in. And after a few minutes, we had about 20 people gathered around. Some of them were crouched on the floor, some of them pulled up chairs, others were standing. And there was this group event that took place,
right,
with questions flying every which way, and me in the middle of it. And I thought, as that was humming along, I'd only been a Christian for about a year, but I thought, this is what was going on in the New Testament. Mm. This is what happened in the marketplace. This is what was going on in the synagogue. Paul addressing the questions in as creative a way as he was able to. He was obviously able to in a very creative way. I was fumbling. But eventually a bell went to indicate the next lecture was due, and everyone grabbed their books and they left, and left me sitting there with the student who had asked the question originally.
Mm.
So I turned to her and apologised. I said, look, I'm sorry, you know, I've been totally distracted from your question. Can you tell me again what the question was? She said, I wanted to know what it meant to be born again, but it doesn't matter now. So I was a bit anxious about this. I said, well, I'm sorry. I'm sure it does matter. Why did you say it doesn't matter now? She said, well, I just have been. And she then said, what do I do now? So I fortunately had a copy of John Stott's Basic Christianity, which was a very wonderful and much used account of the Christian faith. So I gave her a copy. I said, Mary, I suggest you go and read this. It's quite a substantial little book. And she came back the next day and returned it to me and said, I've done that, now what do I do?
Hmm.
I said, well, go and read the New Testament. And also come to church with me on Sunday. and went on from there. And her conversion led to a whole string of people becoming Christians in the subsequent weeks and months. It was quite a pivotal thing, but it all arose out of a group dialogue situation,
okay,
where the gospel was just being knocked around in the common room by a couple of dozen medical students.
Now, I know you were very involved with the Christian Union at the Royal Free?
The Royal Free.
And was dialogue increasingly part of that group's sort of programme, or, you know, the kind of the events you're putting on?
Well, it has always seemed right to me that after a talk there should be a question time, and I've always felt the question time is the most valuable, often the most valuable part, because the questioner is then vulnerable, and he is obviously vulnerable. How he is one thing to have your pre-prepared flow of ideas, and now there are searching questions coming in from every which way, and you either sink or swim at that stage, and when people ask their questions, there are other people in the room who think, yay, that's a good question.
Mm.
Yes, answer that one.
Mm.
And then the person does, and that's deeply compelling.
Mm.
And they think, yeah, that was a good answer.
So why do you think some are better able to answer questions than others? Or, you know, what is necessary to grow as a thoughtful, you know, answerer?
Well, you've got to, I think you've got to do the business. You've got to wrestle with the questions. If you haven't personally been challenged by the problem of suffering or the historical credibility of the New Testament or the uniqueness of Christianity and the world's religions. If you haven't personally wrestled with these things, then you're not going to give very credible answers. So I think it depends a lot on the thoughtfulness that the individual gives it. Now, that is a lifetime's work, really. I'm still reading, thinking, and wrestling with some of the issues that I was superficially wrestling with all those years ago. Okay, I read rather deeper, heavier books on the subjects now, and hopefully give better accounts of myself in answers that I can give. But it is a lifelong task, I think, the Christian's got to give himself. If he's committed to mission and to sharing the faith, he's got to not only be able to give a good talk, he's got to be able to answer people's very probing and proper questions.
And how do we know what these questions are? So they change each year?
Well, no, they don't. It's a common fallacy that the questions change. And they don't change because the gospel doesn't change. The gospel invites a certain range of questions.
Okay.
So, first of all, is it true? I mean, what evidence is there that there's a God? The questions about Christ don't change. Well, hold on, is his teaching remarkable? Was his character impressive? What did he really claim? What was his view of himself? What is the evidence surrounding the resurrection? The question about other religions automatically flows out. The questions, there's an inevitable truth issue about our view of the world and science. Does science actually fit in with a Christian worldview or not? So actually the basic questions, and there are only a small number of them. I've often talked about sort of the seven deadly questions. There are probably more than seven, but in terms of their basic... It's the same if you're going to make any purchase. Imagine buying a fridge freezer. You want to know whether it works. Is what they say about it true? Is it actually going to keep food suitably cold? You want to know what the cost of the thing is. You want to know... There are a set of fundamentals you have to know. And then you have to ask questions about its relevance. Do I actually need this darn thing? It's going to set me back 300 quid. And have I actually got room in my house for it? Right. Is it going to fit? You know, so you've got questions of truth about what the makers claim for it, questions about your needs and whether this actually fits, questions about how it engages with everything else that's going to go into your house. So it's the same in every department of life. It does narrow down to a basic set of questions.
Now, obviously, if a fridge freezer salesman was unable to answer those questions, the fridge might well stay on the shop floor. Why is it, do you think, that Christians sometimes struggle? I mean, I struggle myself, answering questions. In what way do we kind of facilitate our lack of answers or lack of thoughts?
Well, if you're buying a piece of hardware like a fridge freezer and you want to know whether it fits, you get a tape measure out, you can measure the darn thing, and you can see actually that it's going to fit or it's not going to fit. So there's something very sort of hard about that. Ultimately, with questions of belief, we will not know for final certainty until the day we die. You have to live by what is probable. What is reasonable? Is it reasonable to believe that this is true? And is it more reasonable than the alternatives? So a major part of this dialoguing is to expose the inadequacy of the alternative viewpoints.
Okay.
So Paul talks powerfully about the pulling down of strongholds and every lofty idea raised up against the knowledge of God, and then bringing their thoughts captive in obedience to Christ. So there are two real stages in the work of evangelism. Part of it is the pulling down of other ideas, and then leading on. But we, at the end of the day, we do not know for certain. We live by faith and not by sight. Whereas you're buying a fridge freezer, you're doing it by sight.
Okay.
And you've got something much more tangible.
I guess I was asking, what is it in perhaps Christian or church culture that prevents us from either asking or being able to answer others' questions?
Well, I think the answer here is that it depends who you mix with.
Mm.
If you live in a Christian ghetto, the ghetto world will protect you from the questions that non-Christians ask.
Mm.
And so it's much easier to believe in church than to believe in the office.
Mm.
In the office, there's a different framework going on. And you've got to root into the questions and the worldviews of the people around you if you're to be energized and made to face these difficulties. And you see, at the heart of evangelism, I think it has to be applied to Christ's golden rule.
Mm.
We should treat other people as we want to be treated. We must put ourselves in their place. So we must stand where the unbeliever stands and understand his questions and understand the depth of them and treat them with integrity. Because we, if we were in that position, we would want to be taken seriously, even if our views are silly and can be easily ridiculed.
Mm.
We wanted to be treated, we should treat them as we would want to be treated in that situation.
Thank you, and that's very helpful. We're running out of time, but what resources or events or books and things would you recommend for people who want to take this forward?
Well, it seems to me that the life of a Christian who's concerned to share his faith, he's committed to a life of thinking about these issues.
Mm.
You can't just do this in a six-week course and be set up for life. The depth of the questions, the subtlety, and the new opportunities move on the whole time. So I think you've got to be reading.
Mm.
For instance, one of the best-known authors in Britain at the moment, Philip Pullman, has written a very, I was going to say scathing, but it isn't scathing. You see, it's an intriguing book about Christ, which has got some fundamentally false ideas in it. But we need to try and understand what he's saying. And one of the things he's saying is, isn't Jesus brilliant? Isn't his teaching absolutely amazing? And he is a self-confessed Jesusite.
Hmm.
But he's not a Christian. He's thrown off all the dogma. And he has adopted the view that the dogma has accumulated over the centuries since. Just isn't true. And we can show from the New Testament that that isn't true. That Christ was seen as Lord and Christ from the very beginning from the Jerusalem church. So we've got to make our presentation contemporary. We've got to engage in the thinking of our generation. And to be reading the stuff, whether it's written by Christopher Hitchens or by Philip Pullman or other people who are cogent thinkers, we've got to look at their agenda to provoke our own study and reflection and how we would address the questions that they are raising.
Brilliant. Well, it's been great dialoguing with you today, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks for listening to this episode of UCCF's Christian Persuaders podcast. For more information, go to uccf.org.uk.